Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East, the Jewish world, and apparently the Balkans. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... It's been a record-breaking week in Israel, listener, but not in a good way. Record numbers of coronavirus infections have increased the likelihood of a full lockdown ahead of Rosh Hashanah, while the entire region has been cooking in some of the highest temperatures ever seen here. Always keeping his cool, however, is my guest in the studio today, Anshul Pfeffer. How have you been coping with the extreme heat, Anshul?
Not bad. Yeah, as long as you've got the air conditioner on, you're okay.
And screw the environment, right?
Exactly.
Anshul, I'd like to get cracking, because the good people who used a drone to drop hundreds of bags of marijuana in central Tel Aviv last week have promised a repeat performance somewhere in the country this evening, and I don't want to miss out this time. So let's start with the coronavirus, shall we? Israel passed 1,000 COVID deaths over the weekend and is now the country with the highest per capita infection rate in the world. There's even talk of us adopting the Swedish model. What's going on?
Well, as you mentioned, we're number one in the world. As Netanyahu always promised that we're a superpower, and leaders around the world are always calling him up and asking him, how do we do it, or how does he do it? So now we've gone from, in the space of less than 4 months, being down to single-digit daily infections to 3,000 plus a day. John Hopkins say we're number one, and that's something to be proud of, I suppose.
What happened? Where did it all go so wrong?
Well, from the moment the government ended the lockdown in mid to late May, and Netanyahu told Israelis, go out, have fun, have a beer, have a coffee... you've earned it, or I've earned it for you. There really was no strategy. There was no strategy of how to end the lockdown. There was no strategy of what should come in the lockdown space. Lockdown is a preventative measure. You try and prevent further infection and...
Flatten the curve.
Flatten the curve, and then there is you need a whole load of things in place. You need a much more robust and flexible testing regimen, and you need contact tracing. And Israel had neither of those in place for when the lockdown was ended. Also, you need some kind of a clear policy on how to reopen schools, how to reopen businesses. What do you do with various communities and parts of various sectors of Israeli society who have, as part of their daily lives or annual lives, they have big weddings and pilgrimages and religious events. All these, none of these things are really planned. And what we're seeing now is a failure of any kind of serious planning, policy failure, and a political failure, because a lot of these failings are to do with Israel's rather unique political situation right now.
In what sense unique?
Well, we're seeing a civil service which has been weakened, which is not being listened to. We're seeing ministers and Knesset committee chairmen who are trying to change decisions or make decisions based on narrow interests of their own communities. And we're seeing a prime minister who's totally avoiding taking any kind of responsibility. He was very happy to take the credit in the early months when it seemed that Israel was sort of getting off lightly in the first wave, and when the first wave seemed to be over, he was quick then to proclaim victory for himself and to take the credit for it. But we're now seeing total him absolving himself of any responsibility. We've had for 5 weeks now a corona czar or the head of the task force.
Can we call him coordinator rather than czar? I really don't
like
that.
I quite like the czar thing, but anyway, but it doesn't really matter, because he hasn't been given any real powers. His recommendations are delayed and delayed and delayed and watered down and then defied. And it's very obvious that he's being set up as the fall guy here. And on Ronny Gamzel's narrow shoulders, the whole blame for the situation is going to be placed by Netanyahu and Likud ministers. We're already seeing that happening now in some interviews of various Likud ministers and other Netanyahu proxies. And besides trying to avoid blame and to shore up his coalition, we're not really seeing a serious national policy against COVID. So the numbers are going to continue going up. We're almost certainly looking at a national lockdown over Rosh Hashanah. Mm. And we still don't have those policies and those mechanisms in place for when this next lockdown will end.
Mm. And Ronny Gamzu, who is this coronavirus scapegoat, as we are forced to call him, I think, warned today that the tracing system will only be in place. It'll take another 2 months at least, right?
And also, we know that that contact tracing is only effective at a certain level of infection. We can't really use it at the levels that we have now. The levels have to be brought down to at least maybe a tenth of what they are now, 300 to 400 daily infection for it to be effective. There's right. no
Over
way.
Over the weekend, we got up to 3,000.
Exactly.
For the first
time. I think on Wednesday or Thursday, we were up to 3,000. Mm. And there's no way that it can be effective with this number of daily infections. And as you said, we're still 2 months away from it even being there, and that's now the optimistic time frame.
Mm. And yet, the government appears to be bending over backwards to facilitate the annual pilgrimage to Uman, right, to the tomb of Rabbi Nachman. Netanyahu even appointed a special ministerial team to come up with an outline that would allow 2,000 pilgrims to make the trip.
Well, we've seen here the brilliance of Netanyahu's statesmanship. On the one hand, he's been quietly urging President Zelensky of Ukraine to block the pilgrims. On the other hand, on the local political level, he's been telling his own ministers and the coalition partners, yes, we'll find a way to make it happen.
So you know, trust me, it'll be okay.
So in the same way, he's made peace with the United Arab Emirates without telling any of his ministers. Mm. He's also blocking the pilgrims quietly in his dealings with the Ukrainian government while telling his ministers the opposite.
So he doesn't want them to go? He's not...
I mean, Netanyahu is not an anti-science leader. We've seen in various countries, and Donald Trump to mention one, and various countries around the world, leaders who we often identify with Netanyahu in their populism and nationalism. We've seen some of them being anti-science. We saw Bolsonaro in Brazil denying that COVID is a real thing. We saw
before Trump, his wife was infected.
Before he was himself hospitalized with it. We saw Trump doing the same. Netanyahu was an early believer. He was not a denier. He was one of the first world leaders who really took it seriously. And some would say that's because he's not, unlike the other leaders that we mentioned, he is actually an intellectual, and his politics may be populist and nationalist, but he does understand science and he believes in science. And at the same time, he's also
a political scientist.
He's still a political scientist. And political technologist, some would say, he hasn't. Usually, Netanyahu has managed, I think, throughout his career, to manage both the diplomatic and statesman side of his job and the small local, almost small town politician side of his job. He's used them both, and they've worked for each other. They've gone well together and they've kept him in power. And I think we're seeing now this beginning to fall down. The way that he's concentrated so much power in his own hands, it's not the way that you deal with a pandemic. You need a functioning health system. And the Israeli health system on the front line works very well. Mm. It's understaffed and under-resourced, but it's still very professional. There we go. The medical teams are doing a fantastic job, and the hospitals are holding up. But on the government side, and in this kind of an event, you need also for the ministry, for the managerial side, or the national side of the health system to have the capabilities to be able to look at the country as a whole to see where the infections are happening, how fast they're happening, and to be able to do contact tracing and cut off these infection sequences. That's not happening, and we're already 7 months into this pandemic, and as you said, we're still 2 months away from having a viable contact tracing system, and that just beggars belief.
Mm. The latest threat that we're reading about this morning is that leaders of the ultra-Orthodox communities and even the mayors of towns with large numbers of ultra-Orthodox populations are threatening to sever ties, just to simply ignore the restrictions that, that may be imposed on their communities. How will we handle that?
I don't really think we can handle that, because we're talking here about around a list of around 30 red towns. Mm. In those red towns, about two-thirds of them are Israeli Arab, and about a third of them are ultra-Orthodox. We're talking here about 8 or 9 towns where over half of the ultra-Orthodox community of Israel lives. This is roughly around 400,000, probably a bit more than that, people. And this is civil disobedience on a level that the police can't deal with. I don't think they will want to deal with. We know who the minister in charge of the police is and who he works for. And they're not going to anger their ultra-Orthodox coalition partners. And I don't really see a way out of this beyond a national lockdown. And whether or not months from now people will say, well, we could have solved this with localized lockdowns, but because of political pressure on Netanyahu and because of the political power of the ultra-Orthodox, we didn't do localized, we went for the whole thing for a national lockdown. Maybe a national lockdown probably is the best thing now anyway, but that will also be very difficult to enforce, because we're seeing here, we're seeing it both in the polls, and we're seeing, you and I are seeing it on every street we go to, we're seeing a lack of confidence, a lack of any real trust of Israelis, not just the ultra-Orthodox, but almost everywhere you go, you don't see, you don't meet people who are trusting the government to do the right thing right now. And some people trust Roni Gamzo, but know that he hasn't got the powers, and some people don't trust him either. So there's a total breakdown of any kind of serious confidence, and the lockdown will be very, very difficult to enforce. And to be honest, I can't see a way out of it.
Yeah. So in 6 months or a year or however long it is, when we come to have the national inquiry into the mishandling of the coronavirus crisis, it will be the Bennett inquiry, the Naftali Bennett inquiry. He's, after all, has written a book explaining how we should behave and in order to defeat the pandemic. He's our latest expert on the issue, right?
Well, Bennett wrote a book which I think is more or less based on most of the mainstream medical opinion of as it is now of how would have been and how could be the best way to deal with it, and also he brought his open market theories there and how on the best way to use this crisis as an opportunity for stimulating and revolutionizing the Israeli economy as well. I think that Bennett is obviously one of the main beneficiaries of what's happening now, because he's in the opposition, so he doesn't have to bear any responsibility for what happened in those months when he was still a minister at the beginning of the pandemic. Mm. He demanded and continued to demand from Netanyahu to put part of the responsibility on his defense ministry. Netanyahu, for his reasons, many of his political reasons, refused to do so. So Bennett has been given a way out of any kind of blame for this, and he's obviously trying to maximize it because he sees himself as a future prime minister. And what we're seeing here is a very interesting dynamic in Israeli politics, where usually the divides are like right and left, or religious and secular, and Bennett's trying to make this next election, whenever it is, about competence. And this is not something we usually talk about in Israeli politics, sadly.
For good reason.
And I think that by saying, you know, I had the right solutions, and look, here's a book to prove it, he's making that case, and we're seeing in the polls it's quite effective. He's already up to, in some polls, almost as high as 20 seats in the next Knesset.
Mm. So any poll that's issued these days, for example, the Channel 12 poll from last night, that talks in terms of right-wing blocks and left-wing blocks, that's almost irrelevant now, or less relevant?
Well, the big question is not what actually happened in the next election, because, as we know, the real election is what happens after the election. Is Bennett finally capable of saying to the man who brought him into politics and the man he's admired for so many years, even though that man has not really shown him any gratitude for all he's done for him, Benjamin Netanyahu, is he capable of saying, enough is enough, I want to be prime minister now, and I will work out how to build my own coalition, or maybe reach some kind of rotation deal with another rival to Netanyahu, like Yair Lapid, assuming Yair Lapid is still head of Yesh Atid by then. And the question is Bennett capable of patricide? Because Netanyahu is his spiritual and political father, almost, and he's, you know, he's always been sort of a rival to him, but at the end has always entered his coalitions and supported him. is that really over? And Bennett is saying quietly that he thinks the Netanyahu era is over, but he hasn't yet said publicly that he's capable of wielding the knife. You know, we've got people like Avigdor Lieberman on the right who are sick of and tired of Netanyahu, and people like Moshe Yaalon, but we don't yet have a politician on the right with a serious a political force behind him, something larger than a tiny party like Yisrael Beiteinu or Telem of Yaalon. And Bennett potentially could have in the next election the power behind him to end the Netanyahu era, but the question
it would have to be a right-wing politician, though, is what you're saying. It couldn't, for example, be Ofer Shelach if he unseats Lapid as head of Yesh Atid.
Look, there are lots of permutations, you know, and just a few months ago, Benny Gantz was the man who was going to unseat Netanyahu.
Who? Oh, right,
that
Benny
guy,
Gantz.
Yes, yeah. Tall chap.
Remember
white
him.
Hair.
Back problems.
Right now, the list of potential rivals or challengers to Netanyahu range all across the political spectrum, and there are so many of them. You know, you've got Lapid and Lieberman and Yaalon and Gantz, sort of, and Lapid and Shelach, and, well, there used to be a Labour Party, doesn't really exist anymore, right. And then Meretz, and even in Meretz, who's the leader, Golan or Horowitz, and then you've got the joint list. So many people who want to end the Netanyahu era. Mm. The problem is that they're all split into different parties and different groups and can't really get together behind one leader. You know, there was an opportunity to do that where behind Benny Gantz, but they couldn't agree on how to do it and how to build that majority. And it's only getting worse. The number of challenges is growing almost by day. But Netanyahu, in the end, thrives on his ability to keep at least a coherent camp together. And even if they're in a minority, unless the majority can get its act together, he's still there.
Mm. Is Bibi keeping an eye on the polls? Is he ready to pounce with a snap election when things look favourable? I mean, there are plenty of pretexts he could use to manufacture a crisis, right?
He had one a week and a half ago, right, when he could have called an election over the budget deadline. Mm. And at the last moment, he chose not to use that opportunity. And I think that what we're seeing now is Netanyahu, you know, biding his time. He's got another budget deadline towards the end of December, and then
just before the start
obviously
of his trial.
Obviously, you know, the rumours will once again be stoked, and we'll have a last-minute crisis, and he'll decide either way whether or not to pass the budget or to pass another or to legislate another postponement or to go for early elections. And Netanyahu is a voracious reader of polls, and he's, I think, spooked by the fact that Bennett's doing so well right now, and he's aware that over the next few months the corona crisis could get even worse, so he's not going to take the risk. So he didn't take the risk of going for an early election now. He's been pushing every little kind of diplomatic breakthrough that he could find for all it's worth. Just before Shabbat, he gave out this video of Kosovo moving its embassy to Jerusalem, like, as if it's some breakthrough and a milestone in Zionist history.
We'll get onto that in a second.
And but he's not seeing those things work for him in the polls. You know, you could arguably the deal with the United Arab Emirates 3 weeks ago was a very important breakthrough for Israel. It hasn't helped him at all in the polls. He's continued to go down. His ratings are looking at the domestic situation, at corona, at the economics, and this is something which is not going away, and it is starting to drag Netanyahu down.
Mm.
The question is there anybody really positioned to take advantage of that?
Mm. You mentioned Kosovo, so let's take a moment to welcome our thousands of new listeners in Serbia and Kosovo. Dobrodošli, as they say there.
Hello, Pristina.
Hello, Pristina. I take it you saw the video of the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, looking rather puzzled when Trump announced that Belgrade would be moving its embassy to Jerusalem by next June. That was pretty much the look on my face when I got the push alert about the Trump-brokered deal. Were you as surprised as Vučić and me, Anshul?
No, I think we're going to see things like this happening over the next couple of months in the run-up to the United States presidential election. Mm. And we have to remember, this is so much more about American politics than it is about Middle Eastern or Balkan politics. Trump will be trying very hard, and has been trying very hard over the last few months, to show that he still is the ultimate deal maker. Trump works with what he knows, what's worked for him in the past. Mm. And his big thing is that he claims to be the ultimate, you know, the man who invented the art of the deal. And I think that the deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates was something which, you know, the time had come for such a breakthrough for Israel in the Gulf. We were talking about it for years. But at the same time, the actual timing and the place and the way it was brokered was very much done to help Trump to try and show something. You know, we're not talking here about American politics, so neither of us are a resident expert on that. So I think we can... We don't have to weigh in on whether it's going to help Trump in any way, but Trump certainly likes doing these kind of things. And you know, I think Trump can find Kosovo on the map, but most Americans, for that matter, most people, you know, Israelis either. But he obviously liked sitting there in the White House and presenting what, you know, these historic agreements for what they're worth, and dragging Israel into them is always something which he hopes will help him with some parts of his electorate.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the main story here, again, apart from Trump's efforts to rack up diplomatic brownie points ahead of November the 3rd, isn't the main story the reversal of Israel's policy of not recognizing a country that's made a unilateral declaration of independence? As one Haaretz.com commentator put it, this is nothing more than diplomatic gaslighting.
That's a good way of putting it. I don't think anybody is expecting Israel to apply, or certainly the Netanyahu government, to apply diplomatic logic and say this in the same way that Israel is recognizing Kosovo, now Israel is going to recognize the Palestinian state.
That was the traditional concern amongst, even according to our ambassador in the United Nations.
I mean, there were a number of Kosovo concerns, and the fact is that a lot of countries in the world have not recognized Kosovo, rightly or wrongly.
Mainly those countries which have internal territorial disputes. Spain, for example, has refused to recognize because
countries who don't really want to have problems with Putin's Russia as well. I mean, it's not on the priority list for most countries around the world to get into something like Kosovo. Mm. And I think, you know, perhaps one of the things that we're seeing here is we're seeing a gradual degrading of also the Palestinian issue. Mm. If Netanyahu is not that worried that people will say to him, well, you just recognized Kosovo, what about the Palestinians? And I think he's recognizing a fact here is that, and partly due to him, the Palestinian issue is very low on the global agenda. So perhaps some diplomats in the foreign ministry in Jerusalem thought, you know, had counseled against recognizing Kosovo for those reasons. I don't think this is going to ramp up the non-existent pressure on Israel right now to make any kind of concession to the Palestinians.
Mm. What else might Bibi be asked to do to help get Trump re-elected? Maybe he'll start funding the marijuana drone and say it's a Rosh Hashanah gift from the White House.
Oh, that's certainly something which could help.
Will he go
with
to
some Israeli voters? Though I have to mention that one of the biggest lobbies, almost powerful lobbies against legalization of marijuana in Israel is being run by Netanyahu's sponsors, the Adelson couple, Mrs. Adelson, the publisher of Freebie, you may have heard of, Yisrael Ayom. She's also a doctor who in the past specialized in dealing with addictions. She is a crusader against legalization. So Netanyahu occasionally comes out in a pro-legalization statement, usually on the eve of election, to try and get some of the hips to vote, perhaps, and never does anything about it. A bit like annexation. Mm. It's one of those perennial, unfulfilled election promises. But Netanyahu is planning in a week to go to Washington and take part in this big signing ceremony with the Emiratis at the White House. Mm. That, you know, that's going to be a massive stage. I mean, first of all, I wonder how it's going to be arranged in this COVID time, because Netanyahu, as we know, is quite a hypochondriac, and his wife is a germaphobe, and you know these are the well-known things. Mm. And
I wonder if he'll have the balls to wear a mask in Trump.
I was about to say. I mean, we've seen that Trump enjoys staging very packed events at the White House with most people not wearing any kind of mask. Mm. I wonder how Netanyahu is going to do that because he is physically, you know, he's actually worried about COVID. He's unlike Trump, who seems to blithely ignore it. And I wonder how it's going to run here in Israel. I doubt the level of infection is going to go down in a week. Mm. Netanyahu flying off to Washington at the height of the COVID crisis here it's not going to look very good.
And what if he has to quarantine for 2 weeks when he gets back?
So another question: how they're going to deal with that? They dealt with the UAE delegation last week. Suddenly, UAE was announced a green country. Perhaps there's a medical justification for that. I kind of see it difficult doing the same thing for the United States.
Mm. Even with green countries, though, there are problems. I read a report today that an Israeli businessman traveled to Greece, which is a green country for Israel, and infected 3 government ministers with COVID. So, yes, you know, a trip to Washington.
I mean, the pitfalls on this trip to Washington are many. Mm. And I won't be surprised if it's postponed, but certainly Trump does not want to postpone it.
Mm. Might Netanyahu be going there with a list of the compensation that Israel is going to ask from Washington if and when the massive arms deal that underpinned the whole UAE deal goes through?
Well, the UAE deal, as we know, is basically an arms deal.
Exactly.
With some diplomatic sweeteners,
exactly,
for Israel.
F-35s, drones, something that,
EA-18,
of course, the new
Growlers, which should have been more highlighted, the most advanced electronic warfare airplane in the world. Mm. There certainly is a shopping list which Israel is already presenting quietly, and Netanyahu will back it up in his meetings with Trump when and if they take place. I mean, this is part of something which has been going on for decades. The upholding the qualitative military edge, the QME, is a very delicate dance between America's commitments to Israel, America's broader interest in the Middle East, and obviously the interest of the American arms industry. People talk about America's aid to Israel. It's actually administration subsidies of the American arms industry. You know, it should always be pointed out. And this thing usually happens very quietly behind the scenes and with the military experts talking to their counterparts in the Pentagon and explaining how the best way to the timetables for supplying arms to Israel and to other countries in the Middle East, what exactly subsystems will be in the planes and what missiles will be on them. And now what's happened, it's all been dragged out into the open because Netanyahu insisted on keeping his own ministers in the dark, because he seems to have been economic with the truth at the very least with the Israeli public on this. It's now everybody's talking about F-35s to the UAE. The UAE are insisting that they get them. And they could have got them in various ways and timing and with various add-ons or without them, in a way that the Israeli experts would have been satisfied that safeguards the QME. But now it's all out in the open. It's become much more difficult to do that.
Mm. And the denials certainly don't help.
Well, that's all par for the course.
Absolutely. Anshul, we're out of time, I'm afraid. We didn't even have a chance to talk about Zev Engelmeyer, the performance artist who was arrested at an anti-BB protest.
I think words cannot pay justice to Engelmeyer.
I have to tell our readers to check the website for this story. The protest artist, he was arrested, and this isn't a joke, listener. He was dressed in a way that could constitute sexual harassment of the public by wearing a naked female bodysuit. Good to see that the police have got their priorities right. Yeah.
The worst thing is that they don't have a sense of humour.
Thank you, as always, for your time, Anshul.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich, and to you, listener, for joining us. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.